You went strictly, depending on the ability of your parents, you went strictly out to work, and I went to work when I was 15. Mm-hmm. I wasn't considered desirable, but it wasn't considered unusual. All kinds of kids riding the rods of 14, 15 years old, like younger than that. I took off on the rods when I was 14, 1934.
Which isn't really going to work, was it?
Well, let's say this, that we were looking for work.
Yeah.
It wasn't a skylark. It wasn't, we were looking for work. We had to eat. Your parents could hardly afford to feed you.
What year was that?
Which one now?
Well, when you left, when you were 14. 34, man. Now, I have a number of questions here, specifically on the unemployed organizations, which you were single then, so were you?
Oh, mine was all connected with a single unemployed organization, yeah.
Now, which one were you in, if any?
Well, I was in all of them from 1935 to 1938, end of 1938.
Well, there were a large number of organizations. What were they called, the ones you were in?
Well, there was a Single Unemployed Protective Association, SUPA as it was known as. The Relief Camp Project Workers Union. I'm trying to think of the name of the county. I think the organization that that organized the Ottawa track was the SUPA, the Single Unemployed Protective Association, if I remember correctly. My memory gets a little hazy now as to the names in that particular era, because I was just a sort of rank and file member then, pretty rank and file too, pretty young,
yeah.
Not knowing too much about it all. I'm pretty sure that, and I have to check back, I have to think about this. Was the SUPA in 1935, yeah. The SUPA went along until about 1936, became the Relief Camp Project Workers Union. Changed its name.
Now, what type of organizations were they? How organized? You know, how formally were they organized?
Well, you had a membership card, and they had a hall down at 60 Cordova Street West, which is now a parking lot, but it was quite a large hall, and periodically, from time to time, on certain issues, they would call meetings and organize demonstrations, and like meetings used to go on just about every day of the week when they were in full swing on one subject or another, on one scheme. They were fairly well organized.
Did they have full-time,
to the extent that they had a secretary who drew, I think, a little bit above what his relief would provide him.
And did they have the office at this building?
Yeah.
On Cordova Street. So they're pretty well a going concern, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What about the meetings? What were they about? Was it the
Well, they were
political,
organizing various protests, demonstrations, delegations, all these kind of things, you know.
Now, what about the affiliations of this? Was it affiliated to anybody?
No.
But what about informal connections? Were there communist connections?
Oh, very strong.
Yeah.
Communist Party controlled it.
Just by the leadership or how?
By leadership.
Yeah.
The Communist Party gave the impetus to it. And I think you must remember that in those days that an awful lot of people who were pretty in the unemployed were sympathetic to communism. If they weren't members of the Communist Party, they had nothing to lose. The story can be repeated in other places in the world today. After all, when you're scrounging around and not eating for days on end, democracy, as we call it, doesn't mean very much to you.
Yeah, well,
that simple.
This was pretty well known at the time, was it, by the guys in the organization, or what?
Well, I would say that it was pretty well known. I don't think that it was.
I mean, you knew.
Oh, I knew, sure.
Well, if you knew, but
that doesn't say that we agreed with everything the communists did.
Did you go on this trek to Ottawa?
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Well, I can't go into too much of the details of it because I wasn't a leader of it. I was too young. It was organized, of course, because the relief camps, 20 cent a day camps, which were run on the basis of an army lines, were closed down. Unemployed were forced back into the cities. And then the theme of the communists at that time, and it was all over the world, was to, or not all over North America at least, was to do treks to the capitals of the countries. This happened in the United States, this happened here. This was organized by the unemployed, or by the Communist Party. The leadership was given by the Communist Party, and it was organized in 1935 to protest the conditions of the unemployed. And of course, the unemployed, the single unemployed, were particularly mobile. The method of traveling from one place to another was by freight train. And I can't go into the details of how it was organized because I wasn't in that area.
Have you read this book of memoirs by Liversidge?
No.
There's a book out on it which you might pick up.
Where is it?
Communist Party Headquarters.
Is that?
Yeah, it's listed great. I think I have about 10 copies left, so.
Oh.
For about 75 cents. Which you might look at and see what you think of that. Anyway, in Regina, they get stopped.
Yeah.
On us. And were you in any of the fights at that time?
Yeah.
And it was unprovoked, was it? Or, I mean, what do you remember of this?
Well, we were told and that we came off the freight in Regina, and we were all the name was in those days, jumbled up, camping there, you might say, put it mildly. There were a number of interviews with Arthur Evans within the police, and we started to march down. I can't remember the street in Regina now, so long ago, but first thing you know, we saw the RCMP coming the other way. We kept on going, and then the shooting started. And we didn't stick around that long when the shooting started, I can assure you.
Now, and then you packed up. Now,
They sent us back home.
Yeah. There's some suggestion that the Trotsky's group split off and went on to Ottawa. Do you know anything about that? They kept on going.
Well, they were the ones that I think that went. I think if anybody went to Ottawa, they were strictly an unorganized, disorganized group. There was no organization as such that went to Ottawa, to my knowledge. There was really no organized movement that went on to Ottawa, to my knowledge, anyway. At least I have no knowledge of it. The first time I've ever heard of it.
What was the effect of the Regina riots or whatever dwells on you personally.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, did it affect your political thinking?
Oh. Well, it up until that time, I had not had, because I was so young, I had not formulated too much in the way of political thinking. But the association with various people started to crystallize my political thinking. Before that, I had no concept of politics. I certainly wasn't raised in a working class background. And it wasn't until after that, when I came back to Vancouver, that I got associated with people of left-wing tendencies, and I started to think politically.
So you think it had some effect on you?
Well, I don't think the Regina riot in itself had any effect on me politically. I suppose it was part of the thing. I think the fact that I was going damn hungry had an effect on me more than anything else.
Now, what about the, I was wondering what exactly was the purpose of the unemployed organization, just to...
Well, apart from the fact it was part of the communist philosophy, the idea of the communist unemployed organization was to bring to the attention of the public the plight of the unemployed. You can put it in those words. There were all sorts of political and revolutionary motives behind it, as far as the communists were concerned. But it was essentially to draw the unemployed into an organization which would be organization would bring to the general public the plight of the single unemployed.
And was it, you feel it was successful in that?
Oh yes, very successful, I would say. The results weren't successful, but to a great extent, of providing what in those days was the slogan, work and wages. But the question of bringing the terrible conditions the unemployed were under to the public was very successful.
Now, what other activities did you personally take part in this organization?
Which one?
Any of the unemployed organizations.
Well, after the Regina trek, the unemployed organizations didn't do very much until, I'd say, the fall of 1936, when the provincial government established relief camps here in the province of British Columbia on the rate of 30 cents an hour minus your board. And these camps were set up to primarily make parks in the province of British Columbia. Many of the parks that you go to today were done by the unemployed. Now, you were only sent to camp about 6 weeks at a time, and your 30 cents an hour was held back. You were given so much of what you'd earned when you left camp. I can't remember the percentage now, but I think it was around 40% in cash. And the rest was held back in the form of vouchers, which were given to you, which you cashed every week at the post office at the rate of $4 a week, which was really a method of working for relief. Essentially what it was. Well, In the fall of 36, I presume that the initiation of the communists, the SUPA went out of existence, and the Relief Camp Project Workers Union was formed. And they organized in the camps, and the basis of the organization was to have the camps for longer periods than 6 weeks, to do away with this work for relief, to jack the wage up to the minimum wage of British Columbia, which at that time was 40 cents an hour by law, but the government was working the people for 30 cents an hour, to improve conditions in the camps, I presume these were at least the major objectives of the organization. Well, some of the camps, the conditions were pretty bad in them, and there was a series of strikes and unrest in the camps because of the method of the way the government was doing it. The principle that they did, it was probably one of the best ones they had. They were at least doing something constructive, but the method of payment, the method of of working for relief were pretty unsatisfactory. If you didn't go to work in the camp, you were cut off relief. Relief at that time was $3.05 a week for your room and meals, $2 for meals for a week, and 15 cents a night for your bed. And if you were called up, when you went to the relief office, you were sent out to the camp. If you didn't go to the camp, then you were cut off relief. It was just that simple. And I became active in a camp at Yubo, where I became the camp secretary, and we had some trouble with the camp foreman there over various conditions. The camp closed down, and in the spring of 37, and no relief. Relief is cut off after in the summertime. This is essentially the way the relief worked. It was relief during the winter. In the summer, you fended for yourself. You took anything going. Well, of course, this is pretty unsatisfactory because there was not much work in the summertime too. And the unemployed organization then started to what was known as Tin Can. We had approval from the city council in Vancouver to hold a tag day, which was pretty successful and netted quite a few thousand dollars for the unemployed organization. Then we made another application and we were turned down. So we went out and did it illegally, and the boys were thrown in jail. And during the 37, there were quite a few people, including myself, who spent anywhere from 2 to 3 months in Ocala for the charge of obstructing a police officer. It wasn't the charge of begging on the street, it was a charge of obstructing. And this went on during the period of 1937, and the camps opened up again in the fall of 37. And the same procedure went forward in 37, 38, and which culminated in the post office set down the art gallery in Hotel Georgia in 1938. The whole reason for those, apart from the philosophical reasons that may have been involved, was to the fact that during the summer months, or during the spring summer months, there was no relief whatsoever. You worked in these camps during the wintertime, you got a few weeks ahead on your that you learned, and after that you were cut off. There was nothing. You were left to fend for yourself, and I do mean you were fending for yourself, and you couldn't find a job somewhere, and there were very few jobs. Well, you just starved. It was just that simple. So in 1937, in the fall of 37, I was involved in a strike at a camp at Englishman's River over the food in the camp, and I was fired from the camp after this. Well, it wasn't a strike, we just went a march on the cookhouse one morning, and told the cook we weren't very happy, and he retreated into the bush and put his cleaver in his hand and thought we were going to, I guess we were going to string him up to a tree. I guess that's what he thought, because he was sure a pretty scared cook. About 2 hours, 3 hours later, there was a delegation from the forestry department from Victoria arrived, and a number of us were fired from the camp right there and then. We came back into Vancouver, and we were put out tin canning. That's when I was thrown into Ocala. When I, on my release, the unemployed organization was going pretty full tilt, and that's when the post office, the Art Gallery, Hotel Georgia sit-down was organized.
Might as well go on to them.
What do you want to know about that?
First of all,
about this, because this was, I was in the leadership of this.
You were. Well, I wanted to know who organized this thing, and how spontaneous was it, and how was it spontaneous, or, you know?
No, what extent it wasn't spontaneous. It was pretty well organized by the executive of the Relief Camp Project Workers Union. It was developed over a period of months, the strategy. The rank and file unemployed, there were only a very few people knew that what we were going to do. In fact, there was just a handful. The unemployed themselves didn't know what we were going to do. We participated daily. We had daily meetings for, I'd say, almost months, maybe longer than that now, ahead, and each meeting would culminate in a march through the city. And it would be anywhere from 500 to 1,000 men involved in the march. And we had so much that we couldn't handle the meetings at 60 Cordova. We used to have to hold two meetings, one at 60 Cordova and one at the old hall above Gore and Hastings. I can't even remember whose hall it was now, but it was a hall there, and we used to organize, and we had this thing broken down so there were divisions, and there were leaders in every division responsible for the conduct of their group. It was like a small army. The parades were all properly disciplined, and there were section leaders, and there were division leaders, and it was a pretty well-organized army. And this went on for a period of over a month, and we used to parade through town, and we'd tie up traffic all over town. This was our everyday method of protesting, and we just marched through the intersections and traffic. Well, then, this would be in April and May of 38. Well, coming in June, one day it was decided in the executive that we were going to make a more formal type of protest. And I can't remember the reasons now, but it was decided that the post office was one place we would sit down. The art gallery was another. And why, I never could figure out. Hotel Georgia was selected as the third. Well, we started off on a march on the morning, and it was about the 1st of June, I can't remember dates now, about the 1st of June. And the leaders marched down the street, three different divisions employed, and they were met at three different places. And they started off on their usual daily march. And each division was led into the place that it was selected to go to. Well, I was in, there were four divisions. There were two divisions went into the post office. One division went into the Hotel Georgia, and the other division went into the art gallery and sat down. Now, the rank and file didn't know anything that was going on. But when they were told, or they, when they got in there and they were told, they just sat down. They were that well disciplined. Well, about 2 days later, about 3 days later, and I wasn't in on this in the part of the negotiations because my area was strictly in the post office. Hotel Georgia paid us, and I can't even remember the sum now, but it was a considerable amount of money to us in those days to get out, which we accepted because we had to feed the troops. This was a matter of feeding them. And so we stayed in the art gallery and the post office for 30 days when we were evicted by the police. And I was arrested and thrown into the jug and beaten up and thrown into the jug, and so were a few more of the leaders and a few more of the rank and file. I was kept in the jug for about 5 or 6 days. And I was charged with inciting to riot, I believe. And the charge was dismissed in court. Brody, who was also a division leader in the post office, along with myself, he was put in the hospital. He was never charged. He was badly beaten up by the police. He was rubber hosed. And if you want to look at some interesting pictures, you should get the picture of the Vancouver Sun on the morning of the day after that, because they had the photographers there when the police were rubber hosing us on the street, clubbing us on the street. Our crime being that we'd sat in the post office for 30 days.
This is really punitive beating, isn't it?
Yeah.
It wasn't a key order, it was just to...
Well, on the Sunday morning, we knew that sooner or later something would happen, and we had it pretty well organized. About 5:30 in the morning, I was woken up by one of the guards that we had, said that the police or the RCMP are moving into the back of the post office. So we got up and woke everybody up and said there was something going on. About 6:30, an RCMP officer stood up on, he came over the, you know, the wickets in the old post office are there, stood up on the wickets from the other side and said that we had, I think, 30 minutes to vacate the premises. So we duly called a meeting and decided that we weren't going to leave. And half an hour, the tear gas came over the wickets, and the RCMP charged out of the elevators and over the wickets with their clubs swinging. And the tear gas went, and it was a pretty much of a melee. We weren't armed at all. We had nothing. And the windows were broken, primarily to get air because of the tear gas, and to find an escape route because there were only two doors in the post office and one. The guys were trying to get out, and when the clubs were swinging, and as we got out the door, the city police were lined up on each side of the door, beating the guys as they came out, and just rubber hosing them or clubbing them with nightclubs, you know. And of course, the guys started to spread out along the street. And I don't know who started it yet, and I'll never know to this day, but somebody started smashing windows. They smashed all the windows down each side of Hastings Street, right down as far as Woodward's. I went out the bottom door. I was one of the last ones out, and I was pretty young and pretty fast runner, and I went out through, and then nobody hit me. But two or three policemen charged after me, one on a horse, and I ran down by the CPR station and along in front of that building, which used to be Kelly Douglas, down Water Street, going like, and they couldn't catch me, and I went down, well, they started to catch up to me down Water Street, and I ducked off on the CPR tracks, and they wouldn't follow me. So I went down a block on the CPR tracks and I came up on Abbott. As I came up on Abbott, I could hear the windows breaking in Woodward's store. So I ran up along Woodward's store, and first thing I know, there was a prowler car after me, city police prowler car. Well, I went up behind Pender Street now, up along the, under Georgia Viaduct. And this policeman going after me, and I running, and I came to the dead end. There was nowhere to go. There was False Creek, and I was arrested and taken down to the city bucket. As a result of all this, I got pneumonia, tear gas pneumonia from getting, and I ended up in Vancouver General. So that, very briefly, is what happened. The art gallery, Du Bois, we knew that if there was going to be trouble, and we had already agreed that in the art gallery there would be no destruction whatsoever. I mean, that was, at any time. I mean, not that we had planned, but we were not going to let those, it was always agreed that there would be no mutilation of the art. Well, this was our real key, was the art gallery, because that's what they were afraid we were going to do. And I think one of the reasons why they hadn't moved on us earlier, because they thought that we would probably mutilate the art in the art gallery.
How successful was this? The whole thing, did it get you anywhere? The post office? The sit down?
How successful
was it? Well, I mean, did it get you relief or any attention?
No. Well, it got lots of attention.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. I think the relief camps opened up maybe a little bit earlier, probably in September, rather than way on in November. I can't remember any direct results of this that were, I would say that immediately put everything in the hands of the unemployed, no.
What about, who were the leaders of this then?
Well, the leaders were divided into what I would consider two groups. The members of the Communist Party, who really were instrumental in organizing this, did not go into the post office or art gallery. They left us young bucks to carry that out. The leaders of the unemployed were, that is, in the art gallery and the post office, there was Steve Brody, Jack Lucas, who now works for the Teamsters, myself, a guy by the name of Webster, who I've never seen again, a fellow named Harris, who's in the art gallery, and that would be about it, as far as the, and then there were a number of people. Outside, there was a fellow by the name of John Matz, which was not his correct name because I've seen him later and he's under another name now. A fellow by the name of Ernie Cumber, who I've never seen again. A guy by the name of Doc Campbell, who I understand is up in the interior. I've never seen him, but other people have seen him. Bobby Jackson, who is he's not in 217, he's barred from membership in 217 because he's a communist. He's been working in one of the mills under 217's jurisdiction. He was very active. That would be about it.
And Brody was, he's the one that's most often mentioned.
Brody.
Yeah. See,
Brody was the leader of Division 1 in the post office, but Brody was the guy who was who seemed to get the attention from the press. But I wouldn't say that he was a leader above all anybody else. He was merely made so by the press. He was merely the division leader of Division 1 in the post office. There were two divisions in there.
You were in the other division.
Well, there were two division leaders of each division. There was Brody and Webster in Division 1 and myself and Lucas in Division 2. But Brody was the guy who got the eye of the press and got the... And he used to think, and I just remember it's a long time ago, your memory gets pretty hazy on these details, but if I remember correctly, he was elected by the division leaders as the public relations, the voice of the one guy who spoke to publicly on behalf of the unemployed in the post office itself. And that's where Brody got the reputation as being a leader, but in, he was only one of four who were in there.
This money you collected all went to, it was handed out as your own form of relief, or did it go to the organization, or where did it go?
Well, it went to the organization and was supplemented by donations by the public who were pretty sympathetic to us, who used to come down to the post office and drop money in the box we had in the doorway, which we ate two meals a day, one in the post office, which used to be a salad made up by women who I think were largely organized by the party, but who were sympathetic and made up green salad every day. And then we had, by the money we collected, we used to have one meal a day down at Harold Winch's fish and chip shop down on Hastings. And we used to have to take out a group, send them down to eat, bring them back, send another group down. This went on all through the day. You had one meal of fish and chips, and you'd send down 40 men at a time. One would be going down, one would be coming back, one would be eating. We always had somebody out eating all the time at the post office, but we always had somebody in. And the art gallery the same way. We used to march down to eat.
What was the effect on the single unemployed of the demonstration?
After?
Yeah.
Well, it was no longer an effective organization after that. It seemed to... can you make us a cup of coffee, Marilyn?
Yeah, but...
What are you taking?
Cream and sugar.
Cream and sugar.
Cream and sugar.
Yeah. It was no longer an effective organization after that.
Why? Was it demoralized or what?
Essentially, I would say that. That probably would be so. Many of the fellows dropped out. I dropped out of the picture because I was a pretty sick boy. And then there was the relief camps were reinstated, I think, in September. And I'm just going strictly by guess now. And were kept on until probably March of the following year, which was 39. And then in 39, of course, the war broke out, and which was
solved.
An end to unemployment. I can't remember any activities of the unemployed organization in the winter of 1938.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any anecdotes about this? Particularly the office, post office said that,
I suppose I have over time. The city police had some provocation. We had very little to do, and we used to make up songs, which we used to sit outside the post office in the evening and sing. A few of us, the police were all of us around the post office, but used to stay across the other side of the street. And we used to sing songs such as, at that time, somebody had stolen $1,500 bail out of the city police safe. And we made up a song, "Who Stole the Bail?" And we used to sit and sing it to the policeman across the street. I don't imagine this endeared us to the police too much. I won't say that was enough provocation for them to start beating the guys on the head with rubber hoses, but we used to beetle the police because, frankly, we were on one side of the fence and the police were on the other. I mean, we weren't very chummy, certainly not as far as the RCMP was concerned, because the RCMP were known up and down the land to beat guys up for riding freight trains and to turn dogs loose on them. You know, they talk about dogs now, and the dogs were still in evidence in those days, and police dogs were turned on guys with for the crime of riding a freight train. And I have seen myself guys being beaten on top of a boxcar by a Mountie with a riding, one of these loaded riding crops that they have with a whip on one end and a club on the other. So we were pretty hostile with the police always. The police were regarded as an agent of the state. We were antagonistic, and we never left any stone unturned if we thought we could needle the police. I suppose there were many anecdotes. I used to be able to think of them, and I haven't thought about it for years. I can remember that we got so many donations in the post office of clothing and things, I became better dressed than I had for years. In the morning of the riot, of course, all I had on was a shirt and a pair of pants, and when I got out of jail the next Thursday, all my nice clothing was gone. Cleaned up and thrown out, and I was back to my shirt and pair of pants again. Because everything we had was in the post office. We were living there. You slept right on the floor, and you had your clothing all in a little kit bag or a gunny sack or something like that, and it was gone. I suppose if I thought over a period of time of the rather peculiar things that happened, I suppose I could think of some. It was pretty serious to us, of course, at that time. But I suppose we had our humorous moments. I suppose the thing in the public was the smell in the post office of 500 men, unwashed men, laying down there for 30 days. As much as we tried, we no provision anywhere for anybody to take a bath, and I guess the post office got pretty high in the mornings. Matter of fact, I talked to old George Curry, who conciliation officer down here, who was in the building, and he said, "Oh, it was terrible in the mornings to have to go in there." I can't think of anything particularly humorous though. Mm.
There's been some suggestion that whenever there was a fight, the communist leaders would always be, wouldn't be around.
That's true. Well, they see what they did was, and I can tell you who they were, the people who masterminded these things. But when it came down to sitting down in the post office, fellows like myself, Brody, Harris, were the guys that went in, and the good staunch members, the executive of the party, and the unemployed fraction, I think they called it, weight fraction were out. They were not involved. Now, that doesn't say they weren't communists in the post office, but I'm talking about those who were in leadership. Now, of course, there's another thing that happened, of course, that I was in the periphery of, at least, was after the on Sunday morning, a bunch of us were thrown in jail, and the Communist Party organized a great protest meeting in Powell Street grounds for the afternoon. And it was a tremendous mob turned up because the people in Vancouver were, by and large, pretty sympathetic. And I don't know how many thousand people turned up to Powell Street grounds, but the party boys started to whip them up. And Harold Winch was there, and they started to move from Powell Street grounds over to the police station. Ostensibly, I suppose, to protest the imprisonment of us guys in the bucket. Well, things were pretty tense because it would just take something and that mob would have charged the police station and taken us out. The police were prepared. Harold saw this, and he, Foster's car, Chief Foster, the police officer, chief of police, was the car was parked outside the police station. And Harold, from what I'm told, because I was inside and I couldn't see out, got up on top of the car and made probably one of the most important speeches Harold ever made, because if Harold hadn't have calmed that crowd down, there would have been blood and guts to spill in Vancouver, because the police would have come out shooting, and I don't know where the thing would have gone from there. It could have been what the communists wanted, a small revolution started. I mean, the climate was just that right in Vancouver for a revolution. And let's not kid ourselves, I mean, it was pretty bad. And that mob was going to move in on the police station, and once they did that, I guess the police would have fired, and there would have been another major riot in Vancouver. And I'm not too sure that if it had have been, that a riot wouldn't have gone to all proportions. The mood of the people, the mood of the whole population was one almost revolutionary. I mean, this was not only the unemployed, this was the hundreds of married unemployed, the hundreds of guys working for 25 cents an hour, you know. Hundreds who weren't even classified as unemployed, they were just scrounging for a living. And you have to appreciate this climate. I mean, most people you today, unless they experience that situation, just can't appreciate it. You can appreciate it in a remote sense, but the degradation of humanity was so bad that people just had nothing to lose. Well, you know, when I hear people yakking off about communism and all the rest of it in the world, I can appreciate why that people in an underdeveloped country are not that damn concerned about democracy or freedom. They're concerned with filling up the wrinkles in their belly. And that's exactly what we felt about. Democracy, freedom, and all these high-sounding words didn't mean a goddamn thing to us. Not a damn thing. The fact is that if you eat once every 3 days, you were lucky. It was just that bad. And I existed on what was known as coffee ends, two donuts and a coffee for a nickel. And for days we existed on that. Well, our relief was $2 a week to eat meals in restaurants and the 15 cents a night for bed. Now these are pretty, even in depression days, it was a pretty bad standard of living. So nobody had anything to lose. Why not? And I wouldn't say that, I'd say that we warred with the communists, fellows like Brody, myself. I wouldn't say we warred with them. I don't think we were basically unsympathetic. We were quite sympathetic. We just disagreed on tactics, that's all. We weren't Trotskyites, we were just, I don't know what the hell we were. Damned if I know. I think basically the reason why we weren't members of the party is we were just young bucks and we wouldn't accept the discipline of the party. But I can't say that philosophically we were in any disagreement with them. Probably we were more of an anarchist than anything else, you know.
Was there much attempt made to sign you up?
Oh yeah, sure. Oh yeah, sure. Matter of fact, I attended two or three party meetings, and I would have joined the party, except that I got into a violent argument with the secretary, by the name of Matz, at one meeting, and walked out. And that was the end of my, there were all kinds of, the party meetings that I attended. We used to attend them, I tell you where they used to be, down in the old Ukrainian temple down here, I don't know if it's still there now, but it was back of Pender down in Dunleavy, somewhere down in there. It was the Ukrainian. That was where the communists used to hold their meetings. The party used to hold their meetings. They had an office up on the corner of Beatty and Hastings, up in that block across from the Dominion Bank building. Is the Dominion Bank building, that old building there. Fergus McKean was the secretary of the party at that time, Fergie McKean. Oh yeah, sure, they recruited, they were recruiting all the time for single unemployed in the unemployed movement. It was pretty fertile ground for them.
How did they, did they do any propaganda work inside, or how did they go about this?
Oh yes. Yes, at the unemployed hall, you could buy all the communist literature pamphlets you wanted. At all their meetings, they made sure that their party members were cut. I was probably one of the very few who got to be in a position at the meetings of leadership who wasn't a member of the party, and I think maybe they did that because of two factors. A, I wasn't a member. Secondly, I was a good chairman. That's where I learned my chairmanship ability, was in the unemployed days. They used to elect the chairman at every meeting. It wasn't the president as such. The chairman was elected at every meeting, and it seemed that I got to be the chairman of all the meetings because I seemed to have a knack for controlling or for running meetings. But all the key speeches on the... but I was told, and of course I went along with it, fine. I mean, it was all rigged up ahead of time that I was to recognize at a certain time, recognize Ernie Cumber, recognize John Matz, or recognize Doc Campbell. I saw nothing wrong with this. I mean, it was okay with me. I mean, and they were good speakers, let's face it. I mean, they had they were positive, they knew where they were going. Party fraction had cleared all this before, and it was down at the right time. I was all for it. I was nothing wrong with me to have the party organizing things. Somebody had to organize them. Now, you asked me a question the other day, affiliation with trade unions. I remember going on a delegation to the... to the Trades and Labor Council. An old, out here, was the president of the local... Trades and Labor Council, Benga. A delegation went pleading for affiliation with the unemployed movement, which was rejected by the Trades and Labor Council. Mm. I suppose it was rejected on two grounds, if I can remember. One, A, that they needed the Trades and Labor Council knew the political leanings of the leadership of the unemployed. Secondly, is that it wasn't a trade union. It wasn't a working group. I mean, this problem has come up since the war with right here. I mean, yeah. The question of organizing, and this is where we went against, and I think largely on my influence, to a point to my influence, the Congress took the position that they could not organize the single unemployed. And we bucked over that position in BC and said, well, if we don't, there are other people who will do. so we will undertake the leadership. But this was again not in accordance with Congress policy, because I can remember very distinctly the trade union movement in Vancouver. Nothing to do with the unemployed. Oh yes, you get all sorts of sympathetic resolutions passed, bias resolutions passed, and protests to the government that they better do something, but nothing else.
What about money? No money?
To my knowledge, no. I doubt very much if there was any money ever contributed by the trade union movement. Now, I can be wrong, but I never
heard of it. They might have taken a collection.
Matter of fact, I don't know of anybody contributing money to us. I mean, we have to scrounge our own. Talking about money, you want to hear humorous anecdotes. We held one of these unofficial tag days, and we put out about 500 men with tin cans in every corner, and we collected, it was a Saturday night, we collected about $12,000 in the city all day. We counted this in the hall down at Cronulla, and it was all in nickels, dimes, and maybe quarters, but mostly nickels and dimes, and it was a huge bag of money. So we never thought about what we were going to do with this. I mean, in the sense of keeping it. We knew what we were going to do with it, but we had to keep it somewhere. So, Jesus, what the hell are we going to do with this? It's 11 o'clock at night. So it was decided that we would, after some, we'd take it up to the police station and have it put in their safe for safekeeping, you see. So, I'm in charge of this $12,000 in a great big bag, so I get a bodyguard to go up from 60 Cordova right up Cordova Street. And escorted up. So I went in the door packing this big, big bag of money, and my bodyguard stayed outside, and they figured, well, it's in there, and so they disappeared. So I go in and I plump this down on the counter, and the police say, very sorry, but because of this $1,500 bail episode that I was explaining to you earlier, we can't take it. So I said, well, Jesus, I don't know what I'm going to do now. So I pick up the bag and out I go, expecting to pick up my bodyguard. They're not there. Here's me sitting on Cordova Street at midnight, Saturday night, with $12,000 in that big sack. What do I do now? Not knowing where to go. So I bravely, and I do mean bravely, walked down Hastings Street carrying this bag. Christ, in those days for $12,000, they would have killed me right on the spot. Like, holy Jesus, the hall's closed up, everybody's left the hall, where do I go from here? So, holy Jesus, what am I going to do? I'm not going to take this with me. I mean, you know, Christ, I can't take this, back this around all night. So I just thought of an old Pennsylvania hotel across from the NBC Electric down there. They still call it Pennsylvania or not. So I walked in the lobby there, and I said to the night clerk, I said, can I put this bag in the safe? And he said, what is it? And so I told him, and he said, okay, we put it in the safe.
Oh, I tell you,
I was a pretty scared boy for a few minutes.
Yeah. That's what they did in Regina too, didn't they?
Yeah.
Is this a standard procedure?
Yeah. Was tin canning.
No, what I mean, getting the money in the RCMP.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about what they did in Regina, but this was the first time we'd ever done it there, because usually when we made collections before, we'd made provision for securing it somewhere, you know. I can't even remember where. I think we just put it in the bank. You know, we'd get like $10,000 or something in collection, and we then distribute it to the unemployed. And, oh, I forget now. 40 or 50 cents a day, something like that. It really, then we had another system going, raising money called the mummy sheets.
What's that?
Well, we'd issue a mimeograph sheet, and the guys would go out every morning around houses asking for donations to the unemployed. The bugger used to keep most of it. The bugger was an awful rank, and I know one guy there made an after living at this, you know. But a lot of guys turned it in, and the guys would go out with the bumming sheets. Then we had the beer parlors. I used to do this. We used to go out to 10 can of beer parlors, and I'd make a speech in every, I was in speech in every beer parlor in this town. We just walk into the beer parlor and make a speech on behalf of the unemployed. You'd have 10 guys with you, and you'd just go around all the tables with a tin can. And we used to collect enough to keep the boys going that way. We used to do that all through the winter. Every night we'd go around the beer parlors.
I was going to go back to your support from labor. This is one of the questions I had. Was this the only attempt you made to affiliate to?
Well, I think there had been previous attempts, but I had no, you know, I mean, oh yes, I think there had been many previous attempts. But it's the only one I have personal knowledge of.
Mm-hmm. Did you not get any help, like using their halls or anything like this?
No. Now, that doesn't say that certain individual unions weren't pretty sympathetic and probably did contribute. Now, I can't remember. I mean, the only thing I can remember, and you must remember, is that it's pretty damn close to 30 years ago now. And the only real incident I can remember is going up to the Trades and Labor Council and making, I think Doc Campbell made the speech in front of them for an affiliation with them, and it was rejected. Now, I presume that there were many, don't forget the unions weren't very strong, they were essentially limited to two craft unions.
Mm-hmm.
Not very strong in themselves, I don't imagine they had much money. They certainly didn't have much power. Certainly weren't great. There was no, virtually no industrial union in existence at the time. The CIO was just coming into existence. I don't think it had got here by that time. I doubt very much if it had got here. And there could have been unions who gave money, but I don't know. I mean, those details,
were most of the members about your age, you know, teenagers and so on?
Oh, no. There were a number of teenagers, but they were old men. There was no particular group.
I saw.
Oh, no. Many old men were in the post office, many war veterans in there. One of the things that did happen, I can remember, is the second day in the post office, the Legion advised all their war veterans not to participate in this. And some left on the advice of the Legion.
Many?
I don't think there were many, no. But I do recall having a discussion with two or three of them over the fact that the Legion had told them not to partake in these demonstrations. And I think that maybe, to my recollection, maybe two or three did leave. That would be all.
Did you get much help from the CCA? Was there any tie-up there at all?
Well, I can't say. I can't say. Now, to us, you see, and to me at that particular time, as strange as it may seem, and I think to many of us, there was very little difference between the CCF and the Communist Party. And now that may sound hard to imagine, but most of us were pretty naive politically. We knew something was wrong in the country. At least for myself, I didn't regard the CCF and the Communist Party as being too much different. Now it's possible. I don't recall any direct dealings with the CCF at that time, or direct organization by the CCF. Now, there could have been. Now, then I'll, let me qualify that there could have been. The organization, as I know, that I was directly concerned with or was organized by the Communist Party. Now, you take the Women's Auxiliary that they arranged to feed us in the post office. We were responsible for collecting vegetables and food and whatnot. Now, I know it was organized by the Communist Party, but could have had many, many CCFers in it, because it was a front organization, you know. And I think I'd have to leave that question to somebody who was more vitally concerned with that than me. Like Harold, since somebody like Harold, I could give you more detail, but I have no knowledge of it. I didn't know that the Communist Party was.
Well, there was a council of the unemployed with the various organizations represented on. Grant McNeil talked about that. Do you know anything of that?
Well, this would be married, unemployed, single, unemployed. This was out of my...
out of your mind.
I don't recall. Now, wait a minute. Tonight I got out of jail. There was a meeting held at the Moose Hall down on Burrard Street, and I was sent up as a speaker from the unemployed. And I just got out of jail, and I was a pretty sick boy. I had pneumonia and didn't know it. Next morning I went to hospital. I only went to this meeting, and I was sent up to speak. Scared to death. The place was packed. There was about 5,000 in the hall, and they had loudspeakers out. Burrard Street was plugged. On the platform was Harold and Fergus McKean and Grant was there. I can't remember all. I remember Harold, and I can remember Fergie McKean, the Communist Party. And I made a speech. I don't even know what I said yet, but every time I opened my mouth, it was a great clapping. I was just a kid, you know. Holy Christ, I talked to the unemployed, you know, in the hundreds, but this was a mob. Jesus, and the sick to boot. I didn't mean it. And it seemed to me that was organized by the unemployed council, that meeting, that protest meeting. And I can't remember who else was on the platform, but I do remember Harold and Fergie McKean speaking, and myself. And there were a number of other people, but I can't remember who they were at the time. It was a tremendous meeting, but it was one of the old good old working class meetings. Everybody said, yeah, terrible thing, but that's about all there was to it. The next day I went to hospital, so I lost track of just exactly what was going on at the time.
And then...
actually, it was that night I went to hospital.
You personally, I guess, did you go into the war after the...
Yeah.
And then you got involved. How did you get involved in unions, like you're right now?
Well, of course, I was pretty socially conscious by this time.
Yeah.
And I always took an interest because of my background, and partly because of the exposure to the Communist Party and the propaganda, which was not limited merely to unemployed. It was limited, you know. I read all their stuff, but I got quite a grounding in basic Marxist philosophy, I would say. And when I got out of the end of the course, he joined the forces because, A, they cut us off relief. The first thing that happened, we were on relief in 1939, the war was declared, they cut us off, and we figured. And there was no question of philosophy or patriotism or anything else. It was just a question. We figured we were going to be drafted anyway. And there was no relief, and we might as well go and join up. But what the hell? We weren't patriotically inclined. We didn't want to fight the capitalist war or the phony war. We were just a matter of economic circumstance. We after all, if you've been kicking around this country for a number of years and going from hand to mouth and sleeping in boxcars or anywhere you could and eating coffee yams to exist, even the prospect of three meals a day and some clothes in the Army or the Navy was pretty appealing. Just that simple. And I didn't want to join the Army, although most of my friends joined the 1st Division and I joined the Navy, but all my friends that I kicked around with were in that 1st Division in the Sea Force and didn't come back again. Then, of course, after the war, I came out and I got a job, and I was immediately became interested in the conditions, and from there on, I kept going.
You know, you spent, well, you must have spent about 6 years in this, or close to five or six.
Four and a half.
Now, I was just wondering what kind of personal life a young unemployed would lead in the late 30s. I mean, what I meant is, for instance, at that age, people got with girls. Now, if you're, this is very personal, but what I meant is, did you get entirely cut off any kind of personal
social
life
relationships?
Yeah, or anything. I mean, that
well,
young people do around in their teens.
Yes, you know? Pretty well. When you're unemployed, when you're living like we did, your opportunity to meet girls was pretty limited because you were living down in Skid Row or in that area. You had virtually no money. Any money you had went to fill your stomach. Secondly, to put some clothes on your back. You certainly, I mean, I can remember going around this town virtually in my bare feet. I mean, my shoes, and I had no money with which to repair my shoes. You must remember that relief in those days in that area was $3.05 a week, which was given you in vouchers, $2 for meals, which, well, if you took it down to one of the Chinese cafes, would give you 2 1/4 on a meal ticket. For two, they give you 2 1/4, which would allow you 2 15-cent meals a day and 15 cents a week for tobacco, which bought you one package of tobacco and one package of papers. You were allowed 15 cents a night for bed. This did not allow for any personal, you couldn't repair your shoes, you couldn't buy shaving soap, you couldn't buy razor blades, you couldn't buy any clothes at all. There was nothing. And you got these things by using your wits, or by, if you could possibly supplement your income in some other way. But you just, now this obviously didn't lead you to conducting a social life. And then, of course, many of us got involved in, you might call, almost the revolutionary fervor of this thing, and we devoted all our time to it. And this excluded anything else. Now, that doesn't say that from time to time we wouldn't get involved with some girl who came from somewhat similar circumstances and were sympathetic to us, because we're women and girls and families who we met through these activities and were sympathetic. But it certainly didn't lead, as I said earlier, when you first came in, there was no such a thing as being a teenager for us. There was no life. I mean, you came right out of school and you came into the hard facts of society that says that you had to eat. And what instigated these protests was the inadequacy of relief, but secondly the fact that it only went on for probably 4 or 5 months of the year, and the rest of the year you were left to your own devices, which involved riding the rods all over the country looking for work under any circumstance. I suppose that things didn't have the significance of that age that they would have now. You know, the internal politics of the situation didn't interest me to the degree it would have done now if I had been involved in the situation, because I hadn't had the experience. I hadn't had the background to differentiate between all the forces that were at work in this area that I would now because of the experience I've had. This is the unfortunate part of trying to assess the whole thing is that to me and to most of us at that time, this was just a matter of a great protest with us. We weren't involved in any social movement. We weren't particularly interested in philosophies, be they socialist or communist at the time. Although I'd say that most of us were sympathetic to a revolution, obviously. As I said earlier, and I think probably what I said earlier is true, that I don't think many of us youngsters cared to differentiate or did differentiate between the CCF and the Communist Party. Things were too immediate and too desperate for us to be involved in philosophy. When you're not eating for days on end, you're not primarily interested in any high blown ideals. You're interested in filling up your stomach, and the immediate concern is that immediate need, not.
What did you do for work during the summer?
Well, we would. In the springtime, the annual exodus on the freight trains would take place up in the interior or down to the prairie. Most of the unemployed would rely on the harvest to supplement their income, either the harvest on the prairie or fruit picking in the valley or haying. I got a job in the summer truck driving. I picked apples in the fall, which would make me enough money to buy a new outfit of clothes, which will last me through the winter when the relief came due. Pretty generally, that's about what the unemployed did. They just moved around in great herds on freight trains looking for unemployment or employment in areas where they felt there was some. The problem was that you would hear a rumor in Vancouver that the farmers in Kamloops were looking for all kinds of men to go haying, and that night there would be 300 men take off on the freight train and descend on Kamloops looking for one job of haying. This was one of the problems. This was the way we supplemented our income.
So you really did. You went out and looked for work, all right, during the summer.
Oh, and in the winter, you know.
In the winter too. Right?
You used to hear the politicians and the members of the clergy, other people, the press say the trouble with these unemployed is they won't work. But I stood myself in a lineup of, I'd say, probably 500 men outside the old slave market, as we used to call it, which is now the Labor Relations Board on Dunsmuir, and now on Dunsmuir, which used to be the labor exchange or labor market at that time, you know, it was the hiring plow. It would start to snow at 10 o'clock at night. The city of Vancouver was paying 40 cents an hour for shoveling snow. And the line would start forming at 10 o'clock at night. I would stand there all night until 8 o'clock in the morning to get a job snow shoveling at 40 cents an hour. And I have stood there myself in a lineup that extended over two city blocks long all night. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, after the snow turned to rain, we stood all night for nothing. And they said we didn't want to work. I have been out in the snow, stubble snow in Vancouver, in a pair of Oxfords, with snow up to my knees, soaking wet, to get 40 cents an hour, and had to wait 3 weeks for my six-hour check, $2.40. and they said we didn't want to work. And honestly, it was a huge...
How long was there still went around? People said that they didn't want to work.
Oh, yeah. This is true. Yeah. But anytime there was any rumor of a job, now, sure, there was always a certain amount of unemployed who didn't want to work. They didn't want to work at the wages that were going. I mean, they didn't want to go into a sawmill where a guy was supposed to be getting 40 cents an hour and was only getting 30 and say, all right, I'll work for that wage for 20 cents, which is what these people meant by work. They wanted to go around and undercut some other guy. There were many unemployed who would sooner starve than do that. Now, there was always a, I would call it, a minor percentage of unemployed who didn't want to work. That's true right now. It's been always true in our society of a group who didn't want to work. But I can show you the evidence and of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men who would stand all night. If you ever stood all night in the snow, I can assure you it's the most unpleasant thing because you're almost frozen.
Yeah.
To get a job shoveling snow at 40 cents an hour. And hundreds of them do it.
This brings me to an other thing now. Was there much done to keep unemployed from scamming on strikes? Do you remember any of this?
There were no strikes to my knowledge. There were very few strikes.
Yeah.
There was a strike in the lumber industry in 1936, if I recall rightly, but there were no major strikes. But let me tell you that a strike in that time would have been was almost a suicide because there were all kinds of men who would have gone to work through a strike, and so I can understand the reason why.
Yeah.
I can understand in those days. I can't understand that now when there's all sorts of unemployment insurance and at least enough to I would say that unemployment insurance or social assistance is going to, it's considerably better than nothing. But in those days there was nothing. And when you've gone for 3 or 4 days without eating, and you lose any consciousness of any responsibility to yourself or your fellow man. You're an animal. Just basic. Now the question is, I often talk about two people who wouldn't go through this stage. You see, if you and I decided tomorrow that we weren't going to eat until Saturday, we could do it if we had to. That's not hard.
You know you're eating Sunday.
I know that on Saturday I'm going to eat. But the dreadful thing about being unemployed in these days was that you didn't know when you were going to eat next. It was just that simple. You just didn't know. And that was the demoralizing thing about it, was that it wasn't a question of going hungry for 2 or 3 days without a meal. It was a question of when am I going to eat? And how am I going to eat? And if I got a meal two days later, or 3 days later, when would I get my next one? You can go along that so long, and all the basic requirement of existence comes out, and you wouldn't care if you scammed. I don't know whether I would have done, but I'm sure that I wouldn't have blamed anybody under those circumstances if they had done. I mean, it's just that simple. Yeah. You can't relate an ideal to the needs of the human body in that respect. You know, we shouldn't have gone to work for 30 cents an hour, the unemployed, when the minimum wage was 40. But we were damn glad to get it. We were damn glad to get 3 meals a day. And nobody can understand that unless you went through the situation. You know, when you start walking around the city of Vancouver in the middle of the winter with soles out of your shoes, and I mean literally, and no way to replace them, when you're sleeping in a boxcar, wrapped up in newspapers and brown paper to keep warm, And you do this night after night, you can't wash, you can't eat, you can't do anything else. And it's every man for himself. It's just that simple.
Well, I think that's about all there is, unless you have any more.
Well, no, none of this. Probably I can think of a lot more things.
Well, if you can, give me a ring. I better put on, this is Bob's meal. And what's the date today? The 8th of September, 1964. Right?